In 1978, there was a TV series that was fairly critically acclaimed that was called The Paper Chase. I don't know if anyone is familiar with it, but it involves a young Harvard law student, comes from the Midwest, kind of a country bumpkin coming to the big city to study law, and he wanted to especially study contract law under a famous professor who's named Professor Kingsfield. So the whole series was really based on this young guy and his interactions with the famous Professor Kingsfield. Kingsfield, of course, was world-renowned in contract law and had people from around the world that would come into his office to hear his wisdom on various issues. And as a professor, he was known to be a pretty strict professor. They reported that at Harvard, they hired an extra psychologist because of all of the suicides that were happening because of people that were attending his class. He was just really hard on the students and had a reputation of being a real tough professor to have. He made a few comments, and again, this goes back years and years, but I happen to remember the first episode, the premiere of the series, and it led me to the content that we're going to talk about today. Some of the professor's comments, you can see kind of his prickly face in the first few pictures there. He says that a photographic memory is of absolutely no use to you without the ability to analyze that vast mass of facts between your ears. And here's one of the key points that he made, and I remembered it before I knew what it really meant. He says, "We use the Socratic method here. I call on you, ask you a question, and you answer it. Why don't I just give you a lecture? Because through my questions, you'll learn to teach yourselves. Through this method of questioning, answering, we seek to develop in you the ability to analyze that vast complex of facts that constitute the relationships of members within a given society." And another quote, he says, "At times, you may feel you found the correct answer. I assure you, that's a total delusion on your part. You will never find the correct, absolute, and final answer. In my classroom, there is always another question to follow your answer. You were on a treadmill. My little questions spin the tumblers of your mind. You're on an operating table. My little questions are the fingers probing your brain. We do brain surgery here. You teach yourselves the law, but I train your mind." And so with that, we get a bit of an insight in his teaching style was asking questions of the students. And the way that the first episode goes, the young Midwestern student who comes to Harvard to study law, his mom got him a brand new alarm clock, and it didn't go off the first day. So he shows up at class, and he's late getting in. Professor Kingsfield also had assigned all the students reading, even for the first class. Many students assume that the first class will just be a lecture and to talk about what the class is going to cover for the year. But not in Kingsfield's class. He had expected students to have read and be prepared for the first class. And the student, his name was Hart, he wasn't prepared. So as Kingsfield's method often was, each year he would pick one student out, and he says, "Hart, look here. This that I'm holding in my hands, it's a burial shroud. And I'm placing it on you. You're the late Mr. Hart. And what this means is I'm not going to call on you all year. To me, you're dead. To this classroom, you're dead." And what that meant to Hart is, he wasn't going to be able to engage in that Socratic dialogue that's so necessary to develop his mind to become a lawyer. And so the rest of the first episode, we have Hart trying to undo this this situation. The whole purpose for him coming to Harvard was to study under this professor. And he went to the professor's office, and he had to sit and wait while all these people from around the world were meeting with the professor. He didn't have an appointment. And he came in, and he saw the professor, and he was begging for the opportunity because, again, in class, he would be putting his hand up, I know the answer, I know the answer, and the professor would not call on him. And he begged the professor to give him another chance. And Kingsfield said, what if you were a lawyer and you just failed your client and then you come crawling into the judge's chambers and ask for another chance? It's not going to happen. Good day, Mr. Hart. And so with that, the situation seemed hopeless. And at the end of the message, I'll tell you what happened to change the situation. What I wanted to focus on right now is the idea of this teaching style that was used, that was so effective in teaching Harvard law students, not just to become lawyers, but how to think. Socratic questions are a method of pull influencing, not push influencing. So sometimes when you're trying to convince someone, you push ideas at them. So by using Socratic dialogue, by using questions, you're not pushing at someone, you're trying to pull them along. And the nature of the questions that you ask will be successful in helping them think critically in different ways that they might not have thought of themselves. Socrates was born in 470 BC and he died in 399 BC. He was a classical Greek philosopher and is credited as one of the founders of Western philosophy. So quite often you hear this concept of Western thinking and Eastern thinking. Eastern thinking is often a puzzle to us. Western thinking, we understand the idea of logic, and Socrates is one of the first to develop this idea of what they call the Western ethical tradition of thought. But it says Socrates was an enigmatic figure because he made no writings, and so everything that we know about him is what was written about him by his students. To illustrate the use of the Socratic method, a series of questions are posed to help a person or group determine their underlying beliefs and the extent of their knowledge. The Socratic method is a negative method of hypothesis elimination. What does that mean? It means we all have ideas that pop into our head about what we think might be something. And the Socratic method, by asking questions, we can start to throw out, oh, that idea doesn't make sense, so we can throw that one out. And so then by eliminating goofy ideas and thoughts, we hopefully will be left with the best ideas and best thoughts. That's the way that Socratic dialogue works. It says it's designed to force one to examine one's own beliefs and the validity of such beliefs. We have a diagram here that shows critical thinking skills and some of the aspects that make up critical thinking, the idea of reasoning and evaluating. It says the primary goal of Socratic dialogue is not to have unanswerable questions, so you're not peppering someone with questions that they can't answer. It's about critical thinking, the objective analysis and evaluation of an issue in order to form a judgment. So that's what critical thinking can be defined as. The objective analysis and evaluation of an issue in order to form a judgment. And so you might be wondering, why do we want to explore that now? And I was thinking that today would be a good opportunity to take this concept of Socratic dialogue, Socratic teaching, and combine it with something else. And what I chose to combine it with is the subject of, since it's December 1st, the idea of Christmas. There's lots of different times and situations where facts about Christmas come out. And when you're talking to a Church of God person, they have a certain idea in their mind. They have a certain concept. They have certain flow of thought when they hear about Christmas that causes them to that causes them to be very critical about the subject of Christmas. You mean that's not in the Bible? You mean that the churches know about this and they teach it anyway? You mean that the holy days that are in the Bible get ignored while Christmas is what's being kept? You mean it was borrowed from pagans? You mean it was, you know, all of these things are what Church of God people think of when Christmas comes to them. When information about Christmas comes to someone in the world, it often goes like this, right over their head. They don't give it a second thought. They don't think about it at all. What I'm hoping is that through the course of the message today, we'll learn some techniques about questioning, Socratic dialogue, that will help us when we encounter people in society, our friends, the people around us, so that we're not going to be bullying people with a bunch of facts about Christmas that they don't care about and don't want to know about. But when something about Christmas happens, that you happen to be in proximity with someone else, that you'll be able to perhaps pose a question or two about that fact. Shopping. What do you think about all this shopping that happens this time of year? That you'll be able to ask some questions dealing with Christmas in a way that will help people think more critically and hopefully help them to have a similar mindset to people in the Church of God who are called by God to realize that, you know, this is wrong, and here's many reasons why it's wrong. So again, the idea isn't to push our thoughts onto others. The idea is to pull, ask a question to see what they think about it. And it's through those questions and the follow-up questions that you potentially can ask that we can help our friends, our family members, our co-workers to come to a similar understanding about Christmas as we might have. I like the example in the bottom corner, the little cartoon that shows the Flintstones with the Christmas tree in the background, where it says that, you know, they celebrated Christmas before the birth of Christ. Again, they're the modern Stone Age family. The Stone Age ended 9,000 BC, which is 9,000 years before Christ, so it makes little sense that they would be keeping Christmas, although it makes perfect sense that they might have evergreen trees and things like that in their homes, because many of those symbols predated Christ. So that's an example of a little cartoon that might appear on the news or in a newspaper that someone might laugh at and make a comment on, and that's when you can follow up with potentially some probing questions. So to continue, what is it that makes up this idea of Socratic dialogue? What exactly is that talking about? And on the next page, it points out that Socratic dialogue is really just a categorizing of questions into six different categories. So I never realized that this was possible. Usually I think a question's a question. But there's six different types of questions or categories of questions that can make up a process in bringing someone into helping them to better understand an idea or a concept. So some of those six different types of questions and the process that it talks about, so again, it can be numbered from 1 to 6. The first type are clarifying thinking and understanding. And that's where you ask follow-up questions like, can you give me an example? Can you explain that further? Are you saying this? And then they can clarify, yes, that's what I'm saying, or no, that's not what I'm saying, and then they can clarify. So the first part of a Socratic dialogue is making sure that you are on the same page. So you're clarifying to make sure that everyone understands what the facts are. The second type is where you challenge assumptions. And so questions here might say, is it always the case, or is that always the case? So when something happens, does it always happen that way, or does it sometimes happen differently? And then are you assuming, and then whatever the assumption might be? How can you verify or disprove that? So again, we're challenging ideas and assumptions here. So you're asking someone, how do we verify or disprove something? Third type, or the third step in the process, is examining the evidence and the rationale. So you ask questions like, why did you say that? Or how do you know that this is the case? So we're examining the reasoning that's happening. And then always the very simple one-word question, why? Why is it that you think that that's happening? Step four in the process, considering alternative perspectives. Are there any alternatives to what your idea might be? What's the other side of the argument? What? Step five, considering implications of consequences. What are the implications or consequences if what you're saying is true? How does that affect the way I live my life, or how does that affect society as a whole? What if you're wrong? And then the final category is what they call meta questions or questions. Why do you think I asked that question? What does such and such mean? What is the point of the question, or what else might I ask on this subject? So, again, you might want to separate the page, because I'm hoping that you might have a peek at the Socratic process as we deal with the next part of the message. There's lots of different resources I could have called on to bring up the subject of Christmas, and there's even different subjects I could have talked about. For example, perhaps instead of Christmas, I could have talked about the subject of death. When there's a funeral and someone is attending a funeral, that can be a special teaching moment, that they're especially attuned to some of the big questions in life. You know, what is life and what is death and what's going to happen after death? So that could be a whole other subject that we could apply this kind of Socratic dialogue to. When someone is at a funeral home and need some encouragement or cheering up, sometimes just exploring what their thoughts are on death can be important. And so, you know, that's an example of another type of message where this Socratic dialogue could be used. But because it's December 1st, we're going to talk about Christmas. So I chose the Catholic Encyclopedia. The Catholic Church is 50% of Christianity. And if they acknowledge certain things in their encyclopedia and their teachings, we can use some of the things that they teach as opportunities to ask questions, and what types of questions might be applicable for those situations. So again, the intent of this message isn't to be all about Christmas. The intent is to identify how can we help people in their thought process and their critical thinking to be able to challenge themselves. We're going to ask questions. That's going to give them an opportunity to explore why they think what they do and to give an answer. So the Catholic Encyclopedia talks about being an early celebration. It says Christmas was not among the earliest festivals of the church. It lists a couple of the church fathers, and they say they omit it from their lists of feasts. So some of the early church fathers, when they were doing their writings, didn't write anything about Christmas. It didn't really exist. And it says, others ridicule birthdays of the gods and assert that in Scripture, sinners alone, not saints, celebrate their birthday. Others ridicule birthdays of the gods. So just those concepts. And so when that kind of a fact comes out, sometimes they'll say that on the radio. Sometimes there'll be a little article in the newspaper that talks about pagan origins of Christmas. When a fact like that comes out, what are some of the questions that, if you're in a conversation with someone, that you might want to pose? Or what are the categories of questions that you might want to pose? And so I suggest that considering the implications is an example of the types of questions or questions on the question. So when someone says Christmas wasn't celebrated by these early church people right after the time of Christ, what are the implications of that? So section 5, dealing with implications, says, it points out things like, if it wasn't kept immediately after Christ's birth, then why are we bothering to keep it now? Jesus, like, there's nothing in the Bible about it. The apostles didn't keep it as a regular observance. And then when it talks about considering alternative perspectives, we could ask questions like, I understand about Christmas, but it's not in the Bible. There are holy days that are in the Bible that we don't keep. So why are we keeping this one that's in the Bible and not keeping other ones? So again, hopefully that challenges people in a thought process to say, how come this isn't in the Bible? And how come we're keeping these ones instead of the ones that are in the Bible? So that's an example of what I mean by that. The idea of questions on the questions, what does it mean? People didn't keep birthdays, that Christmas wasn't among the early festivals. And so again, one of the types of questions, why is that important? Well, it's important because we're doing something today. There's billions of dollars being spent on this observance. And this particular observance, isn't even part of what our religious teaching is. So again, opportunities to ask questions along some of the Socratic process happen here. The next section in the Catholic Encyclopedia talks about Alexandria, and it says the first evidence of the feast is from about 200 AD. So again, 200 years after Christ's birth is the first evidence of anyone ever keeping it. So again, the kinds of questions that pop up from that have to do with probing the evidence and the rationale. So why are they keeping it 200 years afterwards and not right at the time of Christ? Who is it that started that observance? And once again, the idea of how come we're keeping those days instead of the days that are in the Bible? Other points of in the Catholic Encyclopedia talk about the origin of the date. So the date of Christ's birth on December 21st, it says the Gospels give no help. Upon their data, contradictory arguments are based. The census, it would have been impossible in the winter. A whole population could not be put in motion. Again, in the winter, they wouldn't have had the shepherds in the field. So again, the Catholic Encyclopedia is pointing all of these points out. It's not the Church of God that's doing this. This is, an example of what you might find in a newspaper article or a story on the radio. Because quite often, they will talk about pagan origins of Christmas. And if you happen to be near someone when that happens, it's an opportunity to raise a discussion on the subject of Christmas in a way that's not pushy, because you're just going to be asking them what their thoughts are, but hopefully guiding what their thoughts are in a way that helps them to come to some good, strong conclusions and not just let it go in one ear and out the other. Another section talks about talks about a festival called Natalis Invicti, a well-known solar feast, celebrated on December 25th. And in the Catholic Encyclopedia, they say it has a strong claim on the responsibility for our December date because it happens to be the same date. And for the history of the solar cult, its position in the Roman Empire, the blending of religion with Mithraism, it would seem impossible here to even outline the history of solar symbolism and language as applied to God and the Messiah and Christ. And so even hymns and Christmas offices around talk about, this solar feast being with the idea of Christmas. And so again, one of the points that's listed that I thought was really powerful is the idea that pretty much every month of the year has been claimed by one scholar as when Christ was born. So there is no set date that's really possible to nail down. Every month is possible, and so it's clear that God didn't really want it to be clear to his church as to what that date is. Interestingly, later down the page it says, other theories of pagan origin. So other ideas about Christmas having a pagan origin. And the Catholic Encyclopedia says, the origin of Christmas should not be sought in the Saturnalia. So again, another pagan festival that happens. But for whatever reason, they're saying, oh, don't think that Christmas has anything to do with that. The Church of God would differ. Some of the Church of God literature points directly to Saturnalia and says that, yeah, it is part of it. So it's just interesting. The source that we happen to use will potentially say things that might be different from what you believe. And you have to be able to deal with that. So you don't deal with Saturnalia discussions that Christmas just borrows from Saturnalia in the context of this discussion. But in the context of other literature or other that might come out, it may be appropriate. So the conclusion that the just before the bottom of the page, the author says, the present writer is inclined to think that be the origin of the feast in the east or the west, and though the abundance of other midwinter festivals may indefinitely have helped the choice of the December date, the same instinct which set Natalis Invicti at the winter solstice will have sufficed, apart from deliberate adaptation or curious calculation to set the Christian feast there too. So that whole long paragraph is simply saying, makes perfect sense, all these pagan days happening at that date, that's why the Christmas is there too. That's how they happen to choose that date. So an interesting conclusion. And what does that mean? That the church ignored when Christ was really born, or to try to make any better attempt at figuring that out, and instead picked a time when there's pagan celebrations happening. And, you know, do you think that's right that would happen? So that's a type of a question. Do you think that's right that they just picked a day out of thin air that happened to be when other pagan festivals were happening? And then the whole idea of deception. Why don't they teach? Why don't they teach about Christmas so that people can understand what's going on? They keep that very quiet, and they focus on what the regular celebration is. So the other elements that are in the Catholic Encyclopedia and types of questions that you might ask, I list, and that covers until the middle of the next page, but we're not going to read through all of those. It just gives more examples of how Christmas is pagan and how some of the symbols of Christmas, specifically on the next page, it talks about the Yule log, and it talks about how the church dealt with that stuff. For the Yule log, for example, it says, these calend fires were a scandal, even to Rome. And St. Boniface obtained from Pope Zachary their abolition. So the church hated this stuff, but that's what's kept today. So what does it mean when a church, a Christian church, is keeping a Christian holiday, but when it was originated, they hated that holiday. They hated the symbols that were being used. It shouldn't have been done. In the Church of God, we think that's very significant. But in the world, usually it goes over their heads. Hopefully, we can ask questions when these opportunities come to help people think critically about, yeah, why are they doing that? Or why, you know, why would they have continued with this if the Pope said it was wrong? And again, the final one that's listed there for non-Catholic observances talks about in England, Christmas was forbidden by an act of Parliament in 1644. So they instead tried to make it a fast day, and it was just condemned. The symbols of Christmas were condemned as being heathen. And again, we know from some of the other Church of God studies and literature that some of the, you know, the pilgrims that came over to America also didn't keep Christmas, that they thought that was a pagan day. So for the purposes of learning more about Christmas, so that you can be sharpened up on what kinds of things to be aware of and looking for, and potentially to what kind of questions to ask, I have a list of some of the literature that the Church has on Christmas. So the booklet, What You Should Know About Christmas. The reprint article is Christmas Christian. And then the other one is God's Seasonal Plan, which points out what God's true holy days are. And again, one of the biggest challenges that the Church of God has on Christmas, and one of the biggest problems we have with Christmas, is that it blocks people from understanding what God's true holy days are and what the message of those holy days are to the world. And so if we can get our questions to the point where we can start to explain about what Christmas is a counterfeit of, what Christmas is obscuring, then that would be awesome. Again, there's a list of sermons and Armor of God programs. Armor of God is again targeted for the public. So it usually starts at an introductory level. Sermons tend to be a little more in depth, and so there's a selection of things that are available on the either Canadian website or the American website as well on the subject of Christmas. And again, at the bottom, some more graphics that I'd spotted on the internet that talk about Christmas being pagan, and so many of the symbols of Christmas are pagan. So you can have a look at those. So the last page deals with the subject of asking questions. Asking questions is not unique to Socrates. He didn't invent the question. And interestingly, years before Socrates, we have lots of examples from Scripture of where questions are very effectively used. In the plagues and the Exodus, we turn three times to the subject of children and the duty of parents to educate them. Jews today believe that to defend a country, you need an army. But to defend a civilization, you need education. Freedom is lost when it's taken for granted. Unless parents hand on their memories and ideals to the next generation, we lose our way. So the Torah emphasizes the fact that children must ask questions. And some call these four scriptures here the four children. First scripture that's listed is Exodus 12, 26 to 27, and it says, "And it shall be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service?' that you shall say, 'It is the Passover service of the Eternal, who passes over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households.' So the people bowed their heads and worshipped." So that's one example of a child asking a question and the opportunity for the parent to explain. Number two is Exodus 13:14. "So it shall be when your son asks you in a time to come, saying, 'What is this?' that you shall say to him, 'By strength of hand, the Eternal brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage.'" Number three, Deuteronomy 6, verses 20 to 21 says, "When your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you?' Then you shall say to your son, 'We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand.'" And the fourth point, the fourth scripture, is Exodus 13:8, where it says, "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This unleavened bread observance is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt.'" So again, these four scriptures are often called the four children, because it says one is wise. The first point is a question from a wise child. One is wicked or rebellious, the second scripture. One is simple, as in doesn't understand. And so that's why he's asking about what are these testimonies, statutes, judgments. And then the last one is one who does not know how to ask. And so sometimes your child might not even know how to ask a question. And that one is an example where it doesn't have a question, but it has a parent giving an answer. So reading them together, we can come to the conclusions that children should ask questions. The Passover narrative, the whole story of the Passover, can be constructed in response to and begin with questions asked by a child. And third, it's the duty of a parent to encourage his or her children to ask questions, and the child who does not know how to ask should be taught to ask. Four other awesome examples of great scriptural questioning reveals great knowledge. First example is Abraham. We know that when he had the three visitors that were going to Sodom, that Abraham spoke to God and asked questions. And he said in Genesis 18, 23 to 25, Abraham came near and said, here's the question to God: "Would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for 50 righteous that were in it? Be it far from you to do such a thing as to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall you not judge all of the earth to do right?" So here Abraham is challenging God with a powerful question that says, "You, God, are righteous." And so certainly a righteous God would not do something like this. And so God assesses the question, and he answers it and continues a dialogue with Abraham on this. But again, if Abraham was disrespectful and just said, a righteous God wouldn't do this, you big bully, chances are we wouldn't be reading about Abraham. But because of his cleverness in the way that he phrased his question to God, he got God to change his mind about what was going to happen in Sodom. A second example of great scriptural questioning is with Moses. In Exodus 5, verses 22 to 23, it says, "So Moses returned to the Eternal and said, 'Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it you've sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered all your people at all.'" So again, this is early in the book of Exodus, where Moses is upset because everything that Moses is doing, the Pharaoh is turning around and making it worse for Israel. And that you now have to make bricks without straw. And so Moses comes back to God and he asks some questions saying, what is it you're doing? Because all that Pharaoh has done is evil to the people, and you haven't delivered your people at all. And so, again, a powerful example of a prophet of God, a leader of God, not afraid to challenge God with pretty direct, powerful question. In Jeremiah 12, verse 1, it says, "Righteous are you, O God, when I plead with you, yet let me talk with you about your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? And why are those happy who deal so treacherously?" So again, Jeremiah is looking around at the world, and he sees that good people who follow God's ways are not necessarily prospering the same as the wicked people who are prospering hand over fist. They have money, they have all that they want. They're happy. They seem to be really content with the way things are going. And so Jeremiah is asking God, "You know, righteous are you? How are you allowing this to happen?" And again, the rest of Jeremiah deals with God answering that question. And perhaps the most powerful example of questions in the Bible would be in the book of Job, where the last four chapters are God challenging Job with these kinds of Socratic dialogue questions. Just to begin that, it says in Job 38, God responds and says, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched a line upon it?" So God goes for four chapters of hammering Job, who was, by the time of chapter 38, Job was thinking, "This God, you can't be very righteous if all this is happening to me, because I'm good, and there must be some problems with him because the punishments that are happening to me are not righteous at all." And God, in those four chapters, makes clear the point that I'm God, I'm the Creator, I'm the one that did all this stuff for the stars. I'm the one that can answer all of these questions about, what's the measurement of, from here to here, or how big is the earth. God is making the point that I am all-powerful and all-knowing, and you're Job. And Job comes very quickly to that understanding through this powerful set of questions that God's able to ask him. So at the beginning, I was talking about the TV show The Paper Chase, critically acclaimed. We have a death shroud placed over the young student, Mr. Hart. And finally, Mr. Hart comes up with a solution to get him out of the problem. You can see in the picture that's there, somebody shows up in class wearing a shroud over his head with the little eye holes. And it's kind of comical in the scene in the TV show. The professor always comes in from the side, and he never looks up at the students until he is ready to speak. He opens up his speaking materials, and he has a class list with photographs of everybody and the names beside the photograph. And he looks up, and he sees this ghost character with a shroud over his head. And he doesn't even flinch. He just continues with his lecture, and he asked a student for, explain the details of this case, and the person does it. But you see, he's getting a little bit annoyed having this circus happening in his class. So he asks, "Okay, let's have the details of this case, Mr. Hart." And there's silence. And so he gets mad, he gets around, gets behind Mr. Hart, and he takes this sheet off of his head. And instantly, Mr. Hart starts spewing with great detail the details of the case. He takes the the Professor Kingsfield takes the burial shroud back to him at the front and sets it down. The shroud had to be lifted by the professor before this Socratic dialogue could take place. But once that happened, the last shot in that episode was Professor Kingsfield with a sly little smile on his face, as if to say, "Well done, student. You found a way. You found a way to get out of that challenge that he had been given." And again, the whole series is based on the interactions between Hart and Kingsfield. And so it was a powerful beginning to what became a very critically acclaimed TV series. So in closing, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist was asked, "Why did you become a scientist?" And he said, "Every other child would come back from school and be asked, 'What did you learn today?' But my mother used to ask something different. She would ask, 'Did you ask a good question today?'" And again, the process of asking good questions teaches the critical thinking that is needed by a scientist. And so so that Nobel-winning scientist credited his mother with his ability to think critically and to know how to ask good questions. This December season and beyond, seek to ask good questions, because questions help you focus attention in certain areas, and good questions, Socratic dialogue, helps lead others to form their critical thinking skills too.